Come now to our final study in Daniel, and I want to look at chapters 10, 11 and 12. Now we have an awful lot of material to get through in this session, so I'll have to keep moving pretty efficiently. But the first thing to point out is that these three chapters are all one continuous story. Please, we have to learn to ignore those chapter divisions in our Bibles. Many times the chapter divisions are helpful, but they were put there relatively recently by well-meaning people. They are not part of the Bible itself, so don't get hung up over chapter divisions and verse divisions. There are no divisions, no chapter breaks. This is one story that goes through chapters 10, 11 and 12, and if we understand that, we'll be saved a lot of problems in understanding this. This whole section again has to do with the Greek period. First of all, we'll get our setting. In the opening verse of chapter 10, it's the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. The third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, would mean that the Jews had already returned to their land. Now you'll remember that in 538 the Persians conquered Babylon, and immediately they gave permission for the Jews to return to their land, and they did. You read in the book of Ezra how they returned and they started to rebuild the temple. But then opposition came in, and in the next year after they returned, work on the temple stopped. We are now in the third year and nothing is being done back in Jerusalem. The foundation of the temple has been prepared, but work has now stopped because of opposition from various people round about. That is the time when this message comes to Daniel. Perhaps that's the reason why Daniel in verse 2 is eating no delicacies, no meat or wine is entering his mouth, but he is rather mourning, and it says in verse 2 he's mourning for 3 weeks. Well, we don't know the cause of Daniel's sadness, but I would suggest that that very likely is one reason. However, it's while he's mourning that in verse 4, a man appears to him, a divinely sent messenger, a heavenly messenger. And he describes the appearance of the man. So overpowering is this person that appears to Daniel. Daniel is overpowered. He just melts at the knees, so to speak. The men that are with Daniel actually run away. They're so frightened. But the messenger stays behind and says to Daniel, "Don't fear." He says, "I'm not as bad as I look." And he comforts Daniel. Because he was a shining messenger from God, well, naturally, I suppose, Daniel was fearful, but the man gives Daniel some confidence. And he lets Daniel know what's afoot. You come down to verse 12, and he said, "Don't be frightened, Daniel. From the first day that you set your mind to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard." This great man of prayer, Daniel. From the first day, Daniel started praying 3 weeks ago. That's the reference in verse 12. When you started to pray 3 weeks ago and you fasted and you mourned and you prayed to God, he says, God heard you. What has happened is, he says, that I was coming to you, but I've been delayed for 3 weeks. God actually could have brought you the answer to prayer on the very first day that you prayed. But it's taken me 3 weeks to get here to bring you God's answer. Well, he says, I'm very pleased that you've kept praying for 3 weeks. A good example of perseverance in prayer. God's answer was in fact there from the very first day he prayed, and the man that was bringing God's answer was delayed. It's taken him 3 weeks to get here, but Daniel just kept on persevering in his prayer nevertheless. Now the reason the man was delayed was that he had a battle. There was an evil spirit behind the rulers of Persia. And you get the picture from these chapters that there is an evil spirit behind the leaders of these nations. I'm not saying that the nations themselves have got demon-possessed leaders. All I'm saying is that these nations who are opposing God's people are doing so because there are unseen forces at work, evil forces. Perhaps the reason why the temple has stopped, that is, the temple construction has stopped, is that these unseen forces are working through some of the Persian rulers. Now he says, the evil spirit behind Persia tried to stop me from coming to you with God's answer. However, he says, I was able to fight with him. Verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So I left him there, that is, I left Michael there with the prince of the kingdom of Persia. What was happening was that this messenger was fighting with the other messenger, the other evil spirit representing Persia, and for 3 weeks the battle went on. But then Michael came, he says. Michael came and helped me, and so Michael took over the battle, which released me, and now I'm able to keep on coming to you and bring you God's answer. Verse 14, he says, I have come now to make you understand what is to befall your people in the latter days, for the vision is for some days to come, which we're going to find out as we move along. Again, it's going to be concerned with the Greek period, which is exactly the same as happened in chapter 8, when the same expression was used about happening in the latter days, that is, towards the end of the Greek rule. He goes on to say that, this is just an aside, you might say, that in 538 BC, that is, in the first year of Cyrus, this is now the third year, remember, in the first year of Cyrus, our present messenger, who's just come to Daniel, this unnamed messenger, he went and helped Michael. Michael was apparently trying to secure the Jews' release. Michael was wrestling with the evil spirit behind Persia, and Michael was not able to win. And this man went and helped Michael, and so they got the victory, and as a result the Jews were released. Now, 2 years later, this same unnamed messenger is coming to give Daniel a message, and the evil spirit behind Persia once again opposes. And now Michael comes and helps him. Michael helps the unnamed messenger of God. So, just as the unnamed messenger of God here once helped Michael, so Michael is now returning the compliment, and he's helping this other messenger to fight against Persia. It's quite an interesting little story there in verse 20. He said, "Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I'm through with him, lo, the prince of Greece will come." Ha-ha, that's the clue to what's going to follow. Because after the Persian period comes the Greek period, and then he's going to have a battle with him. Verse 21, "But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael your prince." So Michael's helping me. And then he says in verse 1 of the next chapter, "Once a few years ago I helped Michael. As for me," he says, "in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now he's standing up to confirm and strengthen me. The two of us," he said, "are fighting together against the evil spirit that is behind the rulers of Persia and later will be behind the rulers of Greece." Then from verse 2 of chapter 11, right through to the end of chapter 11, we have the story of the rise of Antiochus. Now if I can just refresh your minds concerning what I said in chapters 7 and 8. Just get ourselves settled for a minute. We're in the period now where Persia has just taken over in 538 BC. Persia rules right through to 333 BC. Let us say in round figures 200 years. And then in 333 BC, Persia falls to Alexander, who with unbelievable speed sweeps from Greece, across Asia Minor, across Syria, across Egypt, across Persia, and he takes control of that part of the world which was previously governed by Persia. But no sooner had Alexander become the leader than his empire split. And it split initially into four major sections which were shared around among his generals, and there was a time of great instability. That is referred to in verses 2 to 4. "Now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be richer than all of them. And when he has become strong, he will stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." Now this is still in the Persian period. But then, stirring up to fight Greece hasn't done them any good, because in verse 3, "A mighty king comes from Greece, and he shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. But," verse 4, "when he has risen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity," that is, no descendants of Alexander ever inherited his kingdom, "nor according to his dominion with which he ruled," because his dominion was lessened, his kingdom was divided. "His kingdom," it says, "shall be plucked up and go to others besides these." In other words, it was fragmented, and the great empire of Alexander very soon was divided. Well, we're concerned with the eastern half of his empire, which was divided into two sectors, the Syrian sector to the north and the Egyptian sector to the south. Now, I mentioned this in the previous talk on chapter 8, but we'll just refresh your mind. The Syrian sector to the north was based on Antioch, and its nearby port was Seleucia. And the kings of the north were called the Seleucid kings, or the Antiochus kings in Syria. Down in the south, you have the Ptolemies, who ruled in Egypt. So you've got the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. Ptolemies in Egypt are the southern sector, the Seleucids in Syria, the northern sector. Palestine is caught in the middle. So you have the king of the north and the king of the south in a constant power struggle, and Palestine is right in the middle. And so the poor old Jews once again are the meat in the sandwich. For the first about 100 years, Palestine fell within the Egyptian sector. If Alexander conquered in 333 BC, and then you have all this fragmentation of his empire over the next number of years, when you come to 301 BC, we are now settled down to this division that I'm talking about. And from 301 through to 198 BC, Palestine fell within the Egyptian sector. But of course, it was the subject of various attacks from Syria at different times. Now, that is talked about at great length here. Verse 5 through to verse 13 talks about the period 301 to 198 BC, the period of Palestine's subjugation to Egypt. There's references here to the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north, of course, the Syrian sector, the king of the south, the Egyptian sector. Now, I'm not going to go through it all, but I'll just point out in verse 5 the reference there to the king of the south shall be strong. And it talks about how they married this one to that, and how there was a battle here and a treaty somewhere else. Verse 6 talks about after some years they make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make peace. And here was an attempt at one stage to patch up the two. And all through from verse 5 to verse 13 talks about that 100 years of Egyptian rule. It's a very interesting period. I'm not going to give you all the details of the different attacks. They're all there. The different attacks, the different treaties that were entered into, how one nation went here and another nation went there, and then there was some other alliance, the treachery, the skullduggery that went on. I have explained it in my book. If you've got that book of mine there on the book of Daniel, I have given you the political details of what's happening here. I don't think it's worth spending a lot of time on right now. So verse 5 to verse 13, the Egyptian period. You come then to verse 14, and Syria conquers Egypt in 198 BC. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the men of violence among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision. Apparently, some of the Jews would cooperate with the Syrian king because they thought they were fulfilling some prophetic vision. So these Jews helped the Syrians against the Egyptians, and they thought that this was going to benefit them. But they found in the long run it didn't, because they then fell under the control of the Syrians themselves. Verse 15, the king of the north, the Syrian, shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, that is in Egypt. And the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his picked troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. So Egypt in the south is now conquered by Assyria. Verse 16, but he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. That is, the Syrian king, nobody can stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land. Ha ha, he shall be in Palestine. In other words, Syria now takes over control of Palestine. Previously, Egypt controlled Palestine, but now from verse 16 on, Syria controls Palestine. It shall be in his power. Now from verse 17 to verse 20, we get further comings and goings. And it's fascinating if you're interested in the history of that period. But once again, I've got the details in the book, and I'm not going to stop and go into them here. But you come then to verse 21, because here we meet Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, Antiochus, you'll remember, was the king of the Syrian sector, who rose to power and then set about the destruction of the Jewish people. All the previous visions in history of chapter 11 have been designed to form the background for Antiochus. And now the remainder of the chapter is concerned with Antiochus. Verse 21. In his place, that is in place of the previous king, shall arise Antiochus, a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He calls himself king, but he's not really a king. And he shall obtain the kingdom by flatteries. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Notice some of the words that he used of him here. He flatters people. In verse 22, armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken. Verse 23, from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. Says deceitful. He shall become strong with a small people. Verse 24, without warning he shall come into the richest parts of the province and shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering them, plundering, spoiling their goods. So he's greedy. Here was a man who was treacherous, contemptible, cruel. He operated by double-crossing people through flattery and through bribery. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. You see again, this man Antiochus, he's got more tricks than you can imagine. And so when he has a war with the south, just when the south, Egypt, thinks it's getting the upper hand, Antiochus has some dirty trick up his sleeve, and so there's treachery again. Well, there are various other adventures he engages in with Egypt, and these are talked about in the following verses. On one occasion, he returned from victory in Egypt, and he then set about his main task, which was the obliteration of the Jews. He had consolidated his power. He had quietened the nation of Egypt to the south. So in verse 28, he returns to his land with great substance. That's the loot from the victory. But his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant. Now, he turns his attention to his main task, which is to deal with the Jews. He shall work his will and return to his own land. Verse 29 through to verse 36 talks about how he had to go to Egypt again to deal with another rebellion in Egypt. We're not going to go through this, but the point is that he was rebuffed because a foreign navy, in verse 30, the ships of Kittim, came to the help of Egypt, and Antiochus had to return home without the extra loot that he was hoping for. Now, of course, this made him very angry, and so when he came to Palestine, he took out his hatred on the people of Palestine, that is, the Jews. We've just seen earlier that some of the Jews were inclined to cooperate with the Syrian authorities. Others of the Jews stood firmly. They were not going to compromise their ancient religion. But there were those who were inclined to compromise with Greek ideas. As a result, there's a certain division appearing among the Jewish people, and often they had bits of skirmishes. On one occasion, they had a skirmish in Jerusalem. Antiochus heard about it and interpreted it as a rebellion against himself, and it gave him just the excuse he wanted now to go in and really teach these Jews a lesson. He could now have an excuse to slaughter them. It was a time of tremendous atrocities. He butchered the people, something frightful. The stories and the accounts that we have of his attacks on the Jews certainly are enough to stir anybody to hatred against him. We know, of course, that he went into the Jewish temple, and there he set up Greek idols inside the holy place in the Jewish temple. He took a pig, which, of course, to the Jews was unclean, and he sacrificed it on the Jewish altar. He burnt any copies of the law he could find. He prohibited circumcision. He forced people to work on the Sabbath and on their holy days. He did everything he could to make himself utterly odious in the eyes of the Jewish people. He was determined to wipe out the Jews. He was a sort of Hitler, if you like, of ancient times. And we find that some of the Jews were prepared to compromise, whereas other Jews withstood him fearlessly. In verse 30, end of the verse, he shall turn back and give heed to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Those who forsake the Holy Covenant there are reference to some of the Jews who had forsaken their devotion to God out of political expediency. Verse 32, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, offering them rewards, giving them positions in the government, by fair means or foul, trying to win the Jews over to his own side. So he seduces some of the Jews by offering them incentives to join with him, but the rest of verse 32 says, the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. They refused to cooperate. And at that time was born what has become known as the Maccabean Rebellion. The Maccabees were a high priestly family. A man called Mattathias was one of the leading priests, and his lusty sons joined together to form a guerrilla fighting force. They are known as the Maccabees, after one of the leading brothers, Judas Maccabeus. And they now established a guerrilla force which fought against the forces of Antiochus. Antiochus had desecrated the temple in 168 BC. The Jews were not going to take this lying down. They stood firm, and so they started to fight. And now the whole of the Jewish people, that is the whole of the loyal Jewish people, were united to fight against Antiochus, and it cost many of them their lives. Verse 33, those among the people who are wise shall make many understand, that is, they shall persuade others to join with them and fight against Antiochus, though they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder for some days. The cost will be high. Nevertheless, they will stand firm and they will fight against Antiochus. Now, of course, there were some insincere people who joined them, and there were some stronger ones who failed. It's always the way, isn't it? Here you've got a group of very brave people who are fighting, yet even among their ranks are some who are insincere. Yet at the same time, on the other side of the scale, you've got all these very brave people, and even among the bravest of people are some who crack when the pressure is on. So although the majority of the Jews are fighting loyally for the defense of their faith and the defense of their religion, among them there are going to be some who are going to fail when the pressure's on. At the same time, there are going to be some who are in there insincerely, maybe because they have impure motives. So that's just a little bit of a side look at some of the different people that get caught up in these types of resistance movements. But the result of all the persecution is going to be there'll be a spiritual cleansing. And that's the point that comes out here. It's an encouragement to God's people to stand firm. Even though there's going to be persecution, there's going to be difficulty, there's going to be trials, there are going to be those who will be slaughtered and butchered, there are going to be those who will fail. But out of it all, he says, God's people will be purified. The persecution is going to have a good effect in the long run. It's going to bring a spiritual cleansing, and those who endure to the end shall be saved. That's the whole message of these three chapters, and that's the title I've given these three chapters, Enduring to the End. Well, they endured for 3.5 years. That temple was trampled underfoot by Antiochus and his forces, but the Jews eventually won. They rededicated the temple and cleansed it. They had restored the purity of their ancient religion. Now we'll just read a few verses to get the drift of what I've been talking about. Verse 33. Those among the people who are wise shall make many understand, though they shall fall by sword, and by flame, by captivity and plunder for some days. I've read that before. Now verse 34. When they fall, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. These are some of the insincere people. But verse 35, some of those who are wise shall fall. So even some of the best of them will maybe stumble and fall when the crisis is on. Some will fall by the sword, of course. Some will fall in battle, to refine and to cleanse them and to make them white until the time of the end, for it is yet for the time appointed. Out of it all, he says, there will be a purified people. Verse 36, and the king shall do according to his will, that's Antiochus. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is determined shall be done. This man Antiochus, he is going to be blasphemous beyond measure. He is going to be the blasphemer to end all blasphemers. And so we have the accounts of some of the things that he does, magnifying himself above everything. We won't go into all the details there, we've seen it before. You come down now to verse 40. Antiochus, during this time, he was attacked by Egypt. There's another reference in verse 40. He was attacked by the king of the south. But the king of the north, that's Antiochus, shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen, with many ships, and shall come into countries, shall overflow and pass through, and he shall come into the glorious land. Now here is a subsequent attack. After the initial attack, when he desecrated the temple and did all those horrible things I just mentioned, after that we find that Egypt comes to fight him. And Antiochus uses it as a further excuse to attack and to butcher the Jewish people here in verse 41 in the glorious land in Palestine. And the poor old suffering Jews suffer even more slaughter. Antiochus then continues on his battle with a victory over Egypt in verse 43. He becomes ruler of the treasures of gold and silver, and all the precious things of Egypt and the Libyans and the Ethiopians follow in his train. And then an amazing thing happens. He hears in verse 44 of a threat from the northeast. So he returns to exterminate that particular enemy, and he comes in verse 45 and pitches his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountains, that is, in Palestine, between the Mediterranean Sea and the central mountain ridge of Palestine. He pitches his palatial tents there in Palestine, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. The remarkable thing is that he just suddenly and unexpectedly died. Just like that. He wasn't killed in battle. He wasn't assassinated. He just died quite unexpectedly. And that was the end of Antiochus. But the Jews had got the taste of victory. Their victory over Antiochus and their restoration of the temple, and of course it was subsequent to the restoration of the temple that you have these later attacks and further atrocities and further slaughter. They carried on their battle. And if I can just finish off the story very briefly there, what happened was, after a further 20 years, they really did win total independence. 143 BC, they had now political independence, and that was the end of Greek domination. Israel was now free for the first time in over 450 years. But we find that they didn't know how to use their freedom, and the country was now hopelessly split between elements which were trying to accommodate to current Greek ideas and elements which were loyal to their ancient Jewish ideas. Here now you have the rift and the development of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees, the more politically inclined people, those who were after power, who weren't so strong on following the ancient traditions, and of course the Pharisees, who were very strong on ancient traditions and were not power seekers, not political power seekers at all. And so the nation was hopelessly divided, and because of this division, ultimately they brought upon themselves the armies of Rome. Quite an easy job in simply walking in and taking control in 63 BC. That, however, is not the story we're concerned with right now. The end of chapter 11 talks about the end of Antiochus. The whole of these three chapters are concerned with this period of the rise and fall of Antiochus Epiphanes, and the encouragement to the Jews to stand firm through this time of great trial. Michael will still be fighting for them. Going back to the beginning of the story, remember that Michael and his other unnamed angel, or messenger from God, they are the two who fight for God's people, firstly against the Persians, and then against the Greeks. It was this unseen ministry. What is it? Angels are ministering spirits, it says. Yes, in Hebrews, the angels are ministering spirits for those who are heirs of God's salvation. Well, here in the Old Testament, you can find these angels fighting on behalf of God's people. In spite of all the persecutions, God's true people will be saved. He who endures to the end shall be saved. So at that time, verse 1 of chapter 12, it's still talking of Antiochus, it's the time of Antiochus. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. Going back to what we saw at the beginning of the talk in chapter 10, when Michael and his other angel were in charge of God's people, fighting for them against the Greek powers. And so there'll be this great time of trouble. He's summarizing it now in verse 1. There shall be this great time of trouble, such as never has been seen since there was a nation till that time. So he says this is going to be a time of tremendous difficulty. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. Through this great trial, he says, and the persecutions of Antiochus, those who are God's people will be saved. Now, of course, we know that many will be killed. Good people will be killed and bad people will be killed. Some of the people who are loyal to God will be killed, and some of those who have compromised their faith and given in to the pressures, they will be killed. Some are truly God's people and some are not God's people. But both good and bad alike will be massacred. But the real difference will come at the resurrection. And so there's a special reward now offered for those who turn others from this path of compromise to a path of utter devotion to God. And those who are devoted to God, even though they may give their lives in the coming slaughter, they can be confident that at the resurrection they will be vindicated. And that's the message of verses 2 and 3. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, that's the loyal ones, and some to shame and everlasting contempt, those that have gone the way with Antiochus instead of fighting against him. Verse 3, those who are wise, this is about the third time we've seen a reference to those who are wise, they're the loyal ones, they shall shine like the brightness of the firmament. And those who turn many to righteousness, you see, they persuade people to stand for God in this time of trial, they shall shine like the stars forever and ever. The vision, incidentally, is sealed for the time being in verse 4, but its meaning will become evident later on. And when that time comes, then he says, later believers will be enlightened by it. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Meaning, they shall run to and fro through this book, through this vision. They shall read it and understand it. Their knowledge shall increase. And so he says, Daniel, shut up these words for those people. Seal the book until the time when it is relevant. And then when the time of Antiochus comes around, the Jews shall run to and fro through the book, read the book, understand it, take courage, their knowledge will increase, and they will now be comforted by the words you've given them here. We find then that Daniel asks a question, and he's reassured to some extent, when he finds that this persecution is not going to last forever. He said it's got a limit. He was told it had a limit in verse 7, or halfway through verse 7. It shall be a time, two times, and half a time, which is generally taken to mean 1 year, 2 years, and half a year. A limited period of time, approximately 3.5 years. Once again, a very approximate figure, but it just so happens that that was roughly the period of time that Antiochus walked all over the temple, from 168 to 165, and then in 165 the temple was rededicated. So that is a small comfort, but it is a comfort. At least they know the time of great persecution does have a limit to it. God's people again can take comfort from that, and John in the book of Revelation draws similar comfort from the limited period of time that this intense persecution is likely to take place. Of course, John is talking about people in another era, but the same principle applies. Well, what is the outcome? Verse 10. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined. There it is again, the outcome of the persecution. The faithful are reassured, but those who are fearful renounce their faith. The spurious cave in, the genuine stand firm. The fearful, they are besmirched, their whole testimony is ruined. The courageous, they are purified. That's the message of verse 10. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. And then he points out that from Antiochus's desecration to the liberation of the temple would be 1,290 days. That's in verse 11. From the time that the continual burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. What's all that mean? Well, he's saying this, that the time of desecration in verse 11, from the continual burnt offering taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, that is the Greek idol set up in the temple, from the beginning of that, the period of desecration will be 1,290 days, which is approximately 3.5 years, or a time, two times, and half a time. But he says, blessed are those who can hang on an extra, 45 days to 1,335 days. Because those that can hang on the extra 6 weeks will see not only the liberation of the temple, but also the complete restoration of temple services, the whole thing in full operation again. Now, of course, there were those who didn't survive at all. They didn't survive to see the liberation. They were killed in the 3.5 years of atrocities. That's why it is that he says, blessed are those who can last it out, and they will see the victory in the end. And, of course, those that last the extra 6 weeks and see the final restoration of services and everything in the temple, then he says they are going to get an even greater blessing. Daniel, of course, in verse 13, went to his rest, that is, he died before these things happened. But, as he says, they are going to apply to something in the end times. The end times, of course, meaning the end of the time of Greek rule. Now, the principle here is well illustrated in other parts of the Bible. And it's interesting how often Jesus drew from this section in applying his teaching to the Jews concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, we saw that in our previous study, but once again, history repeats itself. Anti-God forces are at work, but in the end, those who endure are saved and righteousness is established. You come to the New Testament, and Jesus quotes concerning the abomination of desolation and the desolate sacrilege and the Romans coming into the temple in Jerusalem. He refers to all these things. And then, of course, Jerusalem was destroyed. You come to the book of John, the book of Revelation by John, which was written after the destruction of Jerusalem, and John again uses these pictures, talking of greater difficulties that people in his day were suffering under the Emperor Domitian in the AD 90s. Because all the anti-God forces and all the anti-Christ forces, and of course in the New Testament, the anti-God forces of the Old Testament are now specifically anti-Christ. And John in his letters tells us that the spirit of anti-Christ is always with us. And so the imagery is developed further in that it's applied to that final great revelation when the Antichrist will appear to fight against Jesus Christ. And then we find that when he appears, the man of lawlessness, the man of rebellion, Christ will come and destroy him with the breath of his mouth, it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Or in the book of Revelation, the beast is captured, the false prophet is captured, those who worship his image, and they are all thrown into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So you see, the same things are happening, the same anti-God forces. They're always at work in the world. We are always faced with these troubles to a greater or lesser degree. Perhaps we aren't faced with them as much as other people were, but the temptation to compromise is always there. The difficulties and the persecutions and the atrocities are very severe in some parts of the world even to this day. And it has always been the case. In the time of Antiochus, in the time of Jesus, in the time of John, and so on through history, and it will have its great climax at the end of the age. But what is the overall encouragement or the overall lesson for us in this section? It's found in that second last verse. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. Blessed are those, he says, who endure right through to the end. And Jesus says exactly the same, doesn't he, when he was speaking to the people, recorded in Matthew 24, verse 13, he who endures to the end will be saved. When you come to the book of Revelation, John talks of people who are giving their lives for the sake of Christ. But he says they conquer him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. If anyone goes to captivity he goes. If anyone is slain by the sword he must be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. When you come to the very end of his book, he says, I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom judgment was committed. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony to Jesus and for the word of God, and who had not worshipped the beast or its image, and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life, and they reigned with Christ 1,000 years.